Dear listener, if you like this podcast, I want to tell you about something else you might enjoy as well. Every week, I host an online meetup. In each meeting, I give a presentation on some programming topic, or I bring a guest to the group for a discussion, or I do a code review on a member's code base, or I do some kind of consultation with one of our members. Coming to this meetup is kind of like listening to this podcast, except it's live and interactive, which means you get a chance to ask questions and participate in a conversation with other programmers like yourself. The meetup is also a fun place to meet some new friends. To learn more and to sign up, visit codewithjason.com/meetup. Now on to the episode. Hey, today I'm here with Rand Craycraft. Rand, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Jason. Happy to be here.
Glad to have you here. And you and I got connected through my friend Stephanie Brazil, who works at Thoughtbot, which is where you work also.
Yeah, that was great of Stephanie to connect us. She's a wonderful senior developer at the Thoughtbot team. And it's been great getting to know you over the last week.
Yeah. And tell me a little bit about what you do at Thoughtbot.
I'm the managing director at Thoughtbot. I work on a specific team called Boost, and Thoughtbot's divided up in a really interesting way that as we shifted from the geographic studios several years ago, now we're more focused on the maturity of the client company and the code bases that we work on. So on one far end of the spectrum, we have idea validation clients that we work with. We have another team at Thoughtbot that just works on building out MVPs and early stage first versions of products. My team at Boost, and where Stephanie works as well, is focused just on companies that exist and clients and code bases that already exist. So how do we improve those products and teams to help them get to the next level?
Okay. And are there patterns in the kinds of things your clients are seeking from you? Sometimes, you know, people just want development bandwidth and that's it. But sometimes people might want something different than just bandwidth. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, when somebody is just, you know, looking for the cheapest developers or the cheapest firm, and a lot of times you might hear the phrase butts in seats, you know, that's not Thoughtbot. We're dramatically too expensive for people who are just looking for butts in seats. We are leaders, we are thinkers, we're innovators, we're very senior consultants that can elevate teams and code. So it's to answer your question, we can help move faster. But to get your money's worth, we also need to help you elevate your team and your products with the very senior consultants that we bring to the table.
Okay. And what might that mean? Because if there is a consultant who gets, well, and I'm curious about the format of the engagement too, because some consultancies, they kind of embed a developer on a team and stuff like that. But however that may go, I can imagine various kinds of knowledge transfer, skill transfer, that kind of stuff. So can you tell me about that? Like, first of all, the format of the engagement, if there's any such thing as like a typical format, and then kind of what is, besides just writing code, obviously, like, how does that part go?
Yeah, so the simple answer is there's never a one-size-fits-all solution, right? We're not the kind of consultancy that says, this is exactly how we do things every single time, and you need to adapt to the way that we do things. We evaluate the company, understand their needs, where they're trying to go, and how we can help them with our different consultants. So in offering our developers, our designers, and our product folks, we're able to look at this through a very senior lens and to help make recommendations along the way. And, you know, don't get me wrong, sometimes there is a time where you just need to buckle down and move fast. And you know, our team is especially good at that. but there's also a time whenever we can ask questions, you know, and say, let's talk about your process here. You know, is there an opportunity for a retro that we might be able to have? And look at the big picture and zoom out a little bit and help them move faster, but by taking a look at the bigger picture first. You know, so it's kind of a combination of those, depending on the needs of the client. That sometimes it's just hunker down, and other times it's time to ask questions and improve processes.
Okay. I think that makes a lot of sense. With myself, with my consulting clients and some of the jobs I've had, when organizations or individuals come to me for help with testing, because that's kind of my technical specialty, a lot of the time I find out that they're not really ready to work on honing their testing practices yet, because there are other things that happen upstream of testing that need to be at a certain level of health before improving the testing practices makes sense. I think of testing as, well, a big part of testing is starting with the specifications. And that as opposed to just kind of having a vague notion and then getting started on coding it without really understanding what you're intending to build. So starting with the specifications, but in order to start with the specifications, you have to do some upfront design and thinking. And I've said before on the show that, like, a lot of developers have rightly come to the understanding that big design upfront doesn't work, but maybe the takeaway has been a little too strong, where they hear no big design upfront and they take that to mean no design upfront. And evolutionary design and just not designing is not the same thing. And I found that a lot of organizations are really lacking on that planning side that, in my opinion, is a prerequisite to doing effective testing. So that's a pattern that I've noticed. I'm wondering if there have been any patterns that you have noticed.
Yeah. So in almost every instance, there's a period of discovery, right, of asking those questions and understanding level setting, getting on the same page with what the desired outcome is for the client to set them up for success. Sometimes it's a full discovery product design sprint where you're really in the weeds and understanding what this could be and what needs to happen. Other times it's an hour of onboarding where you can get the discovery out of the way and get right into it. So it's tough to apply the same solution to all problems here. But absolutely some legwork always needs to be done to be able to understand how best to help the client win.
Okay. And pre-show, we also talked about the topic of finding clients. And I've found that whenever I do a podcast or online event or something like that around freelancing, people are always, I get a lot of interest in those. And something that I always tell new freelancers is that it's all about finding good clients. Because even though a lot of freelancing books and freelancing talks and stuff like that are all about business cards and taxes and paperwork and all that stuff, those things aren't a big mystery. Like, that information is not hard to find. The hard thing to do is get good clients. And so I thought maybe we could talk about that a bit. First, broadly, how do you think about that as part of the picture? Like, your role is managing director at ThoughtBot. How does that fit into what you do at the organization?
Yeah. And I look at this through a couple of different lenses and also see some pretty significant contrasts. Yes, I'm working at ThoughtBot now. ThoughtBot has been around for 20 years now and has a great reputation and tons of repeat clients. But I came to ThoughtBot from a much smaller consultancy that I co-founded called Wildebeest. And it's very different selling software for a smaller startup that doesn't have the same reputation that ThoughtBot does. So I understand that, respect that, and learn from that every day. And in the year or so that I've been with ThoughtBot, that's been the biggest change for me. Is you're automatically in the door when you're coming from ThoughtBot. The people at least hear you out because of the reputation, especially in the Ruby on Rails world that we've established. versus at a smaller consultancy that's maybe just getting started, you've got to fight and climb and kick and get your way in to be able to have that first conversation. It's for new people starting out, I would say that the best thing that you can do for your consultancy is to do great work. And that's rhetorical and that's probably super annoying to hear. But whenever you do great work and you have those great clients and they become very loyal to you and they only want to work with you and they take your advice, and even when you can't work with them, you make great referrals and build that relationship, then you end up like a company like ThoughtBot, where you have 20 years of thousands of clients who respect the great work and the outcomes that that ThoughtBot has been able to achieve for all these different clients over the years. And sales becomes a lot more straightforward, and you can really truly focus on how you can help the client through the outcomes versus, you know, really struggling to meet your quota for whatever that might be for your sales numbers.
Okay. Yeah, there's a lot that I want to dig into there. First, going back to the reputation factor and stuff like that. I remember when I was freelancing years ago, I was charging $100 an hour, and I was trying to raise my rate from $100 an hour to 150. And I had gotten to $100 an hour from starting at 50. And so I was gradually raising my rates over time. But I found that once I tried to go from 100 to 150, it didn't work as well anymore. People started to ask me, why should I pay you so much that I'm paying everybody else? And, you know, rates are a bit different now because this was a long time ago. But they would ask me that and I didn't have an answer. And so, like, one thing that I learned from that is, like, if you want to charge rates that are, like, above market rates, you have to have an answer to that question. These days, I don't really have a problem with that kind of thing. The work that I do now is well above market rate, partly because I'm not always offering the same service. It's not just writing code by the hour, which we can talk about more. But also, I've built a name for myself in the Ruby community via my podcast, blog posts, YouTube videos, conference talks. I host my own conference. I host an online weekly meetup, all these things, so that when I'm talking to somebody, it's often the case that they're already familiar with me. Maybe they've been following me for years. And so it's less a question of, should I hire you instead of this other person? And now I'm comparing prices and stuff like that versus, you're the only person on the planet I want to hire because I specifically want to hire you for your expertise rather than just hiring a developer for bandwidth.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. And in my opinion, the market will tell you when your pricing is right. You know, the first thing when you're starting your own consultancy or even working in a larger consultancy and you're thinking about, is my pricing right? Is your funnel full? You know, is your team fully utilized? If your team is fully utilized and, you know, you have a healthy pipeline ahead, then there's something right about your pricing. That might be a time to turn it up. If people are questioning your pricing and your funnel is still full, then, you know, you probably can't go any higher at that point. Now, if your funnel is not full and people are questioning your pricing, you're not in the right place. You know, the smaller you are, the more lean you can be in the right sizing that you can do with your pricing. But you'll know whenever you're priced accordingly, and that's whenever your funnel's overflowing and your utilization is where you need it to be.
I think that makes a lot of sense. Another thing I want to talk about is deciding what service to offer. The natural service to offer for freelance programmers is, again, coding by the hour, but it's susceptible to commoditization. And again, like, it's hard to get away from market rates if you're providing this commoditized service. And what I found is that a good 95% of freelance programmers are really just effectively hourly employees. They do staff augmentation, which, as you know, is when you join somebody's team and you're you might even get a company email address. You join all the same meetings. All the employees join. The other employees might not even know that you're not an employee also. It's a distinction without a difference. The money isn't meaningfully better. The lifestyle isn't meaningfully better. And for me, actually, once I did freelancing for long enough, and once I discovered that like this lifestyle I was chasing kind of didn't exist, I was like, well, this isn't better. And I went back to trying to find a full-time job. Ironically, when I tried to seek a full-time job, that's when I got my best freelancing gig ever. And so that was a whole different thing. But I started asking myself a long time ago, like, how can I get away from this kind of trap? Because it's like, you mentioned the thing about referrals. And the unfortunate thing is, like, if you are a freelance programmer and you find a client who likes you, they're going to want all your time, which is very rational of them. Like, why would somebody want to hire 4 developers for 10 hours a week when they could hire 1 developer for 40 hours a week? And so, and it's more efficient on the freelancer side too. If you can work for just one client for a long period of time, then you don't have to do as much sales and marketing. It's a lot easier. But then it's like, hang on a second. So the picture of success is you just work for one client for many years. That's called a job. That's not anything better. And they're not going to refer you to anybody, because why, if they like you, why would they refer you to somebody else? And if they don't like you, why would they? There's no scenario in which they would refer you to somebody. So that kind of work just doesn't lend itself to referrals and such. It took me a good 10 years to figure out how to get away from that. And I just cracked the code or whatever about a year ago. I started offering consulting services, which I define as providing counsel rather than labor. So people now hire me purely for advice. And again, because that's not commoditized, because they're hiring me specifically, they don't say, I need a developer, let me find somebody. They say, oh man, I'm having trouble. I think Jason could really help me. It's a whole different thing. Anyway, I said a lot there. I want to pause and give you a chance to share any thoughts you might have.
Yeah, I mean, the way you position that, absolutely, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense for people. If they want to be working 40 hours with a client and they're not getting benefits and, you know, acting like an employee, then be an employee. But that's not the case for everybody. You know, there are some folks who enjoy working with different companies, you know, and doing 20 hours here and 20 hours with another company. Or maybe they just want to work 20 hours, you know, and have the rest of their week to themselves. So I think, you know, finding that work-life balance is important for somebody, but completely agree that if you're working 40 hours a week with one client long-term, then get those benefits, girl.
You know, yeah.
Get in there and make your client commit to you, and there, don't let them just get away with, and a lot of states don't allow that, you know, depending on where they are. California, Colorado, or New York, you know, there's strong employment laws that don't allow employers to do that.
So yeah,
I think everybody's looking out for situations like that.
That's how a lot of freelancing careers end. They succeed themselves to death. They go get hired by a client, and they like each other so much that the freelancer becomes an employee, and they're no longer a freelancer, which is neither good nor bad. But for me personally, that's not what I'm seeking.
Yeah. Somebody might also aspire to have their own consultancy and work with their friends and hire partners and offer different services. And in a case like that, where they can scale out with more people and offering more services, then it could make sense, especially if, you know, you're focused on writing Ruby on Rails, and your friend over here is really interested in testing or DevOps, and you can put together a system where you can sell those, you can package those services together, where, to your point, it's a higher level of thinking. You're selling consulting and thinking as opposed to just the transactional commoditization of the hours that you're spending. You know, when you get up to go to lunch or take a bathroom break, you're not getting paid. you know, you still have to live during that time. So is there a way to get to that higher level of thinking that the clients can pay for? Oftentimes that comes through bundling.
Bundling. Tell me more about that.
Sure. So bundling different services, just like the example I gave of, like, you know, you're working with a friend who focuses on DevOps or testing or whatever. You know, can you work with a client to give them all these services through a period of time, maybe through a retainer or a fixed fee model? And these are just some creative ideas for if you're thinking about how you can scale your own consulting business.
I see. Okay. I want to ask you a question that I think I mostly know the answer to, but maybe not everybody is completely aware. You mentioned the advantage of having what you might call brand recognition, trust, that kind of thing with Thoughtbot. How did that come to be? Why does Thoughtbot have such brand recognition, and why do people hold Thoughtbot in such high regard?
Yeah, Thoughtbot holds itself accountable. It's been a really good experience for me so far, learning more about the company. I was familiar with it before I came in, and aware of the playbook and the culture and the values that Thoughtbot holds itself to. Over 20 years, there have been some incredible people who have come through Thoughtbot and have moved on for various reasons over the years. And oftentimes, even just in the last year, we're always hearing from people who are ex-Thoughtbotters who enjoyed their time, respected the company, and they've brought that Thoughtbot culture into their new jobs. And those new jobs expect and respect Thoughtbot for the different values that they've established. And so I think that has been a big factor in Thoughtbot's growth and continuance of finding new clients and developing those relationships by making a great place to work and being great consultants that then go out into the world and then pull Thoughtbot in if and when it makes sense.
Okay. Yeah, and I think a lot of agencies have to market to at least two different audiences. One is prospective clients, and the other is developers who they might hire. And I don't know how much Thoughtbot is consciously marketing to those two audiences separately, but what I think of when I think of Thoughtbot is all the blog posts that I've encountered over the years where I have some question and I Google it and it's a Thoughtbot blog post that comes up. And so for me, I think of Thoughtbot, you know, and it's not just the simple fact that those blog posts come up. It's that I read the content and I think, oh, these people are like smart people. And, you know, obviously there's FactoryBot and the other tools that Thoughtbot has put out that I've used. And so all this influences my perception of Thoughtbot. And so that's where that's come from for me. And I wonder how much of that is marketing to developers versus marketing to prospective clients, and how much there's overlap and stuff like that. Do you have a feel for that?
Overall, we have very little turnover at Thoughtbot. You know, I'm not going to give specific numbers, but I've never seen such little attrition at a company before. So we don't need to necessarily recruit people very often. Whenever we're growing, of course, we're looking. But, you know, we're not one of those companies that have, you know, 30 or 40% attrition year over year, and we're constantly recruiting new people to backfill those roles. But we have people that stick around because they enjoy the work that they're doing, and they enjoy the teams that they're working on, both internally and externally. There's very little, if any, external marketing to try to attract people to work here. It does it itself. You know, the open source work that we do, the blog posts that you mentioned that we put out, we don't have a quota of blog posts that we have to meet. We don't have a marketing department that's saying, you know, more blog posts all the time. These are needs and interests that our individual contributors have on our team of wanting to share their thoughts and their ideas with the world. So we've been able to build an incredible suite of open source products that have over 1 billion downloads at this point. and thousands and thousands of pages of blog posts covering so many different topics that are just generating interest and conversations for ThoughtBot. And that's just become a natural part of our culture now, of, you know, talking about the things that we learn and sharing the knowledge with the world and with our clients.
Okay. Yeah, a lot of organizations, they make claims like, we want the best developers and stuff like that. But it's like, who are you? Like, they've done nothing to build a reputation out in the world. And so when a developer encounters a job ad from them, it's like, well, I've never heard of your company. They're indistinguishable from any other company that's hiring for a similar position. And so, frankly, they end up with a lot of mediocre hires because there's nothing that attracts the good people to them. And so I think that's, whether it was a conscious choice for that specific purpose or not, I think that's something that was a really smart choice on ThoughtBot's part, to have these open source contributions and blog posts and stuff like that, those things that make good people want to work there.
Yeah, and it makes good people want to stay here too, because they enjoy writing this content and talking about what they've learned and starting conversations in the open source community on blog posts and social media. So it's a symbiotic relationship there that we're very happy about.
Yeah, and high caliber people want to work with other high caliber people.
Right.
And so it's kind of self-perpetuating. Either way it goes, you know, like if there's an organization that has a team of mostly mediocre developers, if they manage to hire somebody really good, that person might not stay because they don't want to work with people who aren't at their same level. But I suspect the case with ThoughtBot is you have been successful in attracting these high caliber people, and then they stay because their colleagues are also at that high caliber.
Exactly. There's expectations that that we hold ourselves accountable. We hold our teammates accountable. The theme for this year is setting our own standards. You know, so what does that mean to us? What does that mean to the company? I think that's a great representation of what we expect out of ourselves at ThoughtBot.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious about getting back to attracting clients and such. For me, most of my clients so far have been people who have listened to my podcast for a long time, read my blog, that kind of thing. And I'm looking for more clients now. I'm always going to be marketing myself and doing sales and stuff like that. That's not something I'm ever going to want to cease doing. But there's only so much that's going to be there, you know. For me, my audience is not gigantic. And so maybe the people who have found me through those channels, that's maybe all I'm going to get for now. And so now I'm doing things like going out on the road and physically meeting people in person. I have a snail mail newsletter that I send out every month. And those are some of the people that I'm visiting. It has the benefit that I can see how people are geographically distributed.
That's cool.
Yeah. But I'm curious for your clients specifically. I'm interested in like the bigger companies whose names we would recognize and stuff like that. How do they make their way into the pipeline?
Yeah, there's not a single magic bullet aside from doing great work, getting that the respect in the industry, the recognition for doing great work, and then the culture that we have. Even at my previous consultancy that didn't have the same recognition as ThoughtBot, we were able to get big clients. And you get big clients by having a specialty and something that you're very good at and getting referrals from people that they trust. So when you do great work, you're known for doing great work. People help out others in their circles, and you get the referrals, the opportunities to work with the big companies. On more than one occasion in my consulting career, I've just done some cold outreach to people that I want to work with. You might find a mutual connection on LinkedIn or a job post that sounds like, hey, that's something that I might be able to fill at my company. And be able to figure out, do some a little bit of legwork yourself to find out who you need to talk to, and get in there, start those conversations. And next thing you know, you'll be working with those big companies. Depending on the industry that you're in, there's different meanings of recognition. My last consultancy was more focused on marketing and high polish campaign digital work. So awards were very important there. So after you win an award, then the big companies are interested in you, right? And then after you win a really big award, then even bigger companies are interested in you. So we had a big focus at Wildebeest of trying to win some of those awards so that we could generate more attention and get some of those bigger accounts that would help us grow the company.
Interesting. Well, I'm not aware of any awards for doing good development work, but I'm always on the lookout for things from different industries which I can apply to my work. You know, it might not be apples to apples, but maybe I can at least take the idea. It's like, okay, there's this, the award gives like an aura of prestige or something like that.
It sounds like an opportunity for you, Jason. You can create the sweaties.
The sweaties.
That you do once a year, right?
Yeah, that's great.
The best development.
That's a great idea. Let's see. Oh, yeah, I wanted to ask you, at Wildebeest, you mentioned like kind of targeting specific organizations you wanted to work with. How did you decide? Because there's so many different people you could possibly work with. I've had that same idea, but it seems so arbitrary. How did you make that choice?
Yeah, for me, it was not looking at, wow, that company is really failing in digital interactive marketing. They need my help. I'm going to reach out to them. That's not how you do it. You look at the people who are excelling in that space, that they're doing great work. You know that you share the same idea of excellence. And those are the folks that would likely be interested in your services.
Yeah, I'm so glad you said that, because that's not something I always knew, but that's a lesson I learned some time ago. You know, sometimes my wife will encounter some crappy website or something like that, and she's like, Jason, you know, just in jest, she'll be like, Jason, you should go work for these guys and fix their website. And it's like, nope, if their website sucks, it's probably hopeless. It's if their website sucks, to be honest, probably the root cause is the people in charge. And you're not going to fix that by going to work for them. And I made a choice at a certain point in my career. I don't want to help people who are underperforming grow to the point where they're kind of doing okay. I want to help people who are already doing really good do really good. And that's going to be more successful.
Yeah. The momentum is often there at that point, right? That you can get the ball rolling a little bit faster. I think that's also kind of subjective though, right? That there may be some people out there that would like to be a little earlier stage and help lift up some clients and make that impact. So I think it's different per person what you're trying to get out of your career and where you find the most fulfillment.
I think the point is fertile soil. You want to be working in fertile soil. And it's like the high performance is just the outward expression of that. And so if you see somebody who's performing well, you know that that's going to be fertile soil most likely. And you can help. I'm struggling to extend the analogy, but you know, you can work within that fertile soil even more. But I think you're totally right that you can find people earlier. Some of my clients are people who are earlier on in their career, and maybe they're not yet filling their potential, but just in knowing them and talking with them, I can see that they're smart, conscientious people. And if we work together for a period of time, they can go from here to here and accomplish something really great. Although it can be hard to find those people.
Mm-hmm. Jason, can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
Can I turn this around?
Sure.
I'd like to know what's your outlook on Ruby on Rails? You've been right square in the middle of this for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
I have to admit that I went to a boot camp and I learned Ruby on Rails 12 years ago and haven't used it a lot since, until coming back to ThoughtBot. And, you know, after a long experience in various other technologies, I'm so surprised at how prevalent it still is. It wasn't on my radar. So I want to hear from you, somebody who never left, about what you think the future looks like for Ruby on Rails.
Yeah. Well, I am always hesitant to try to imagine that I know things I don't know. And I think there's a lot of people who pontificate on this topic who honestly don't really know the things they think they know. Like, if you look at Google search trends regarding Ruby on Rails or Stack Overflow search trends, questions and answers and stuff like that, is that really an indication of the market size? Or is that an indication of something else that you're using as a proxy for the market size, but it's not really a valid measurement and you're fooling yourself? I think that's the case with a lot of people. And I'm not saying they're wrong. I'm just saying that they can't know that they're right. So that's one aspect of it. And the other thing is, it's a total mistake to focus on the absolute size of the market. Because for me, for example, I'm just one guy. Like, if, you know, I don't work at jobs anymore. I'm a consultant. But if I did work at jobs, I only need one job at a time. So it's not about the total size of the market. It's about the ratio of the size of the market, the number of jobs to the number of people seeking those jobs. And as long as that ratio is healthy, then you're all set. So the Rails community could shrink down to 100 people or something like that. There could just be like three companies on the planet who use Rails, and I might still be okay, because it depends on how many other Rails developers there are. If there's only three Rails developers in the world, then I'll be doing great. So it's really about that ratio, not about the absolute size.
But so this begs a question of what the future looks like with new companies that are deciding on frameworks. Are you seeing that new companies are still choosing Ruby on Rails? And because I'm thinking about this from a perspective of somebody who might be listening that is considering learning Ruby on Rails, or maybe just got out of a boot camp and they're earlier stage than somebody more advanced in their career like you. How do you feel about the future there? Are they pointed in the right direction, or should they focus and become more generalists?
That's an interesting question. I think it's hard to go wrong in general. Like, if you're going to pick something really obscure and bet your career on that, then that might not be a wise choice. But like, whether you pick Ruby or JavaScript or Python or like anything, it's hard to go wrong because the principles are all the same. As long as you can find a job and then improve on the job, then those skills are going to be transferable to just about any ecosystem. And smart employers are going to realize that. So let's say you choose Rails, and in 3 years, the whole thing implodes somehow and you need to make a change, or you decide you just don't like it, whatever the case is, it's probably not going to be that hard to make a transition to a different technology. Now, how many people are starting new companies using Rails and stuff like that? I have no idea. And nobody does. Like, nobody knows these things. And so I'm hesitant to say anything about that. But the way I would make the decision if I were starting out is, what do I enjoy? And if I enjoy Rails more than the other stuff, I'm not gonna choose something else out of a mercenary decision just because I think there are better job prospects. I'm at least gonna give it a go with Rails, and then, okay, if it really doesn't work for some reason and there some other opportunity falls into my lap, whatever. But since, again, it's hard to go wrong, I would go with, what do I like?
Great. Inspirational stuff for your listeners.
There we go. Okay, it's probably time to start heading to a conclusion here, but is there anything else that you wanted to talk about before we wrap up?
What's your work-life balance like? You know, that's something that I've experienced working as at a consultancy as well as in-house. With work-life balance, have you noticed a difference? I know that that's something that you've experienced both sides as well. Is one side better than the other for you?
It depends on the person and your situation. A big factor in all this is what I call the seasons of life. And I think it's important to recognize which season of life you're in and attune yourself to it. You know, when I was in my 20s, I was single, no kids, and that meant certain things for my job. You know, I worked at an office and then I went home and I just hung out with friends and stuff like that. I wish that I had invested my time a little bit more wisely back then, but youth is wasted on the young and all that. And now I'm in a different season of life where I have kids. You know, earlier I had young kids and that took up a lot of time, and I was earlier in my career, not earning as much, that kind of thing. And that calls for certain behaviors and all that. But now I'm 39. I have a teenage son and another son who's 10. And it's a whole different situation. And all these things, I think, are a factor. So having said that, my personal situation right now is that I'm working a lot. And right now I am making an investment so that I can work less in the future. Even though I'm working a lot now, I'm working less than I used to when I was a freelancer many years ago, because I've figured out how to be more efficient. I figured out how to get away from those market rates and charge a higher effective hourly rate. And so now I can make the income that I need to in less time. And I'm going further and further in that direction. Ideally, I'm only working, just to throw out some figures, like let's say half the time for five times the income of a normal developer job. And I realize that that might sound unrealistic, but a question I like to ask in these situations is, why not? Like, does it have to be impossible for that to be the situation? So anyway, I'm shooting for something like that. So yeah, you asked about work-life balance. For me right now, I work a lot, but I'm making an investment so that I don't have to work a lot in the future. What are your thoughts on work-life balance?
The seasons that you referred to, that resonates with me a lot as well. In my career, I spent the first 10 or so years in New York and the last 10 or so in Los Angeles. And so geographically, there were a lot of differences between the two, just in terms of lifestyle and expectations and just seasons of life. But then also there's the dynamic of working in-house with brands. I get that question a lot from folks earlier in their career when they're thinking about, hey, do I want to work at an agency or a consultancy, or do I want to work in a brand in-house somewhere? And, you know, having a lot of time to think about this, I don't know that you can definitively draw a line and say, hey, person, you're not going to like working at a consultancy or you're not going to like working at a brand. Because so many companies are different, you know, brands are different, consultancies are different. Find a great company that aligns with your values and it's going to be great. If it's the kind of work that you want to be doing, don't let a consultancy scare you away, or don't let in-house at a brand scare you away, that there's great work being done at both. There's also shit work being done at both, right? So
ain't that the truth?
Find the company that you like and somebody that, you know, is going to be your manager that you like and respect and that you can learn from, and you're in the right place.
Yeah. Yeah. The sad fact of the world is that most stuff isn't very good. Like the bottom 90% of everything is just awful. And it sounds cynical to say, but it really is the truth. And so, you know, for a long time, I didn't realize that. And I thought the problem was me. And then I realized that, no, like it's really hard to find a good place to work for. So it might take some trial and error and hopping from place to place to find somewhere that's satisfying.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. Well, Ran, I've really enjoyed talking with you. Where should people go to find out more about ThoughtBot and all that?
ThoughtBot.com. You can find us there. You can find us on LinkedIn. You can give us a follow there. I'm also on there, easy to find. We'd love to hear from people and help answer any questions about ThoughtBot or career ideas as it relates to consultancies and brands.
All right. Well, Ran, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks, Jason.